Now, the Earth is already 1.1 degrees Celsius warmer than the late 1800s, and emissions continue to rise. 2015 to 2021 were the 7 warmest years on record, according to the UN. And this global warming just keeps progressing every year. Now, to keep the global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, as called by the Paris Agreement in 2015, a lot needs to be done. Emissions need to be reduced by 45% in 2030 and reach net zero by 2050. What does all of this mean, and why it's so important for Malaysians and the future generation of Malaysians? We have on the show today Emily Oyenzi, who is the director of the Business Council for Sustainable Development, BCSD, as well as Alia Hasna, who is the co-founder of Bumi. Thank you so much, ladies, for joining us on the show tonight. All right, so as I mentioned in the intro just now, you know, people talk about this net zero target a lot, but we often use or hear the net zero term being used interchangeably with carbon neutral or carbon neutrality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what is the difference between net zero and carbon neutral? Maybe Emily can explain.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you for having us.
Yeah.
I'll start with carbon neutrality. So essentially, carbon neutrality is an organization or a country needs to balance out the carbon emission that they release by either removing it or reducing it or, you know, offsetting it. Whereas for net zero, it's the same thing, but it covers more than carbon emission, because greenhouse gas, actually, it covers more than just carbon dioxide. There is also methane, there's also nitrous oxide, and a few more commonly found greenhouse gases. So net zero is the same thing, but it covers the broader spectrum of all the other greenhouse gases.
The previous administration has set a target that Malaysia would, you know, achieve carbon neutral by 2050. But Malaysia is also one of the over 190 nations that pledged to the UN to achieve net zero. Is Malaysia on track? Who would like to take this one?
Maybe I'll just clarify a little bit on the target itself. So I recall the same thing when the first announcement by the Malaysian government, they call it carbon neutrality as early as 2050. But recently, when I flipped through the latest UN climate change report that our government submitted to the UN last month, they call it net zero emissions by as early as 2050. So that's something for us to ponder, and maybe also to follow up with our ministry, which one are we actually doing. As to are we on track, I guess if you look at the latest climate report that Malaysia submitted to the UN, the emission is still going up, the total, compared to the previous year. But we have to note that there's two different type of target that we're talking here. One is the net zero emission as early as 2050. Another one that's more official, because the government actually submitted in black and white to the United Nations. And that target is actually by 2030, 45% carbon intensity reduction. And when we say carbon intensity, it is carbon emission against, you know, some sort of indicator. Normally, countries will use like either, you know, carbon emission per GDP or carbon emission per capita, which is population. And the one that Malaysia submitted is per GDP. So in that sense, although the so-called absolute emission is upwards, but if we divide it by GDP, I don't have the figure, but it might be actually going down. And if we're going down, then we are pretty on track with the 2030 target.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Alia, what would you like to add on to that? You know, let's just take a step back. You know, why is this target so important? People have been talking about this, you know, since the Paris Agreement in 2015. It's been, you know, over 5 years now. So why is it important? Can you explain to the audience?
Well, I think it's really important that we achieve our sort of, we can say, internal or at least national climate target, because we're all moving in terms internationally towards achieving, to making sure that the Earth temperature is well below somewhere between 1.5 to 2 degrees based on the trajectory that we're going towards 2050 to becoming net zero. And of course, a lot of developing countries, you know, such as Malaysia, Indonesia, and other developing countries, we are also taking quite some time to be up to par with, for example, the more developed countries, simply because we're also prioritizing our economic development as well. So for Malaysia to, you know, sort of have that transition from being very dependent on coal and fossil fuel, it's going to definitely take a lot more time for us to sort of make that sustainable transition as we move towards a cleaner and healthy future for us all. So I can imagine that it would, you know, take time, but then, you know, eventually we will get there if, you know, we stick to the trajectory as we're supposed to.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about this transition, yeah, we understand that, of course, it takes or it requires a very large investment. You know, experts are saying hundreds of billions of ringgit is needed, you know, for investments for Malaysia to actually achieve net zero target by 2050. But with this, we also understand that it requires political will. It's a collaborative effort, right? And also corporate businesses, all of this is very, very important. Mm-hmm. On board to this net zero target. Talking about this, what kind of sectors are actually, you know, the most pertinent when we talk about net zero target?
I'll take that.
Yeah, for sure.
I think a lot of misconception will be kind of stuck in, if we go net zero, then we have to be 100% renewable. That's correct, but that's not the only solution in the equation. We have to also remember the other sectors. So in Malaysia, the main emitting sectors are energy sector, of course, which includes oil and gas, electricity generation, and also transportation. There's also the waste sector that emits a lot of methane, CH4, and also the industrial, the manufacturing sector, they also emits quite a fair bit. And also one sector that's always forgotten in this equation is the forestry. They don't really emit carbon emission, but they're important because they absorb the carbon emission, and that completes the whole equation. So those are the main sectors that we should look at.
All right. So Alia, you know, you work with this new, I would say, a platform called Bumi, right?
Yeah.
It creates an ecosystem for solutions to tackle the climate crisis. Now, this also sort of relates to the previous question, which is the collaborative approach. So where does like, you know, NGOs sort of similar to what you run, what are their roles, basically, and as well as individuals?
Well, I think if we look at the roles, in order for us to move towards a sustainable future, basically, we need to look at what the government is currently doing. So, for example, the current administration, perhaps they could be a little more upfront with, you know, pushing for more stronger ESG regulations, or even as well as sort of creating that opportunity or that space for private sectors to really invest in cleaner technologies, for example. That's just one of the few, right? And then for companies, for example, I think it's time for them to sort of look at, you know, going towards just transition. How do we take people who are working, for example, in the fossil fuel industry, and how can we upskill them and prepare them for jobs in relation to cleaner technologies, particularly in that industry? And I think for the role of society as well, for community, how do we basically engage with our government in ensuring that there is some sort of transparency when it comes to discussing about, you know, what entails in the sustainable future, and what are they basically doing to ensure that we are moving towards there, and as well as, you know, being part of the action on the ground as well to ensure that, you know, they are part of the conversation, because often enough, a lot of communities are often left out in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that point. When you talk about communities, it's probably the indigenous communities, or?
Well, not only just the indigenous community. Of course, we should have a heavy importance to the indigenous community, but as well as the youth, for example, as well. You know, like, you don't often see them part, you know, being at the table having these conversations. And as well as, how do we ensure, you know, to have that somewhat conversation of being having a lot of representation, even like the B40 communities as well. Like, where are they when it comes to these kind of conversations? So I think it's really important to have, you know, everyone present when it comes to these conversations.
Right, that's a good point. Yeah. Now, before we head to the break, I just have one question. You know, with what both of you explained just now, the transition towards becoming more green, or yeah, you know, to reducing carbon emissions, Malaysia, we understand, is not probably the largest emitter of carbon, you know, when you compare to other countries in the region. But when we also compare ourselves with, you know, most of the Western countries, they seem that they're more in line with this. They're more, I don't know, they're already pushing for more greener initiatives. So, yeah, okay, where is this conversation kind of going?
Okay, I'll try. Actually, if we look at the bigger picture in terms of the international climate negotiations, there's always a constant, you know, this dynamic between the developed countries and the developing countries, which Malaysia is a developing nation. And the argument has always been who should pay more responsibility, you know, the polluter pay principle. So Malaysia, yes, we are a relatively small emitter. In fact, we only contribute to less than 1% of the global emission. So there are also arguments like, why should we do so much, right? So again, this goes back to this principle in the UN. We call it the common but differentiated responsibility. CBDR is very mouthful, but CBDR. Meaning everybody has to play their own responsibility to solve this climate change, but you have to do it based on your own capacity. Meaning, if Malaysia, we're only this small, we can do this much, then this is all we can do. Yeah.
And I think just to add on to that, Malaysia is very unique in a sense that, you know, our economy is still growing. And if we make that transition now, it's gonna be a whole lot more easier to ensure that, you know, we're at a space where we can achieve more in terms of climate target without having to really have that conversation of, do we give up economic development just in, you know, to ensure that we have a healthier environment, right? So if we do that now, we do not have to have that struggle, basically, down, like, in the near future. So I think it is, I think, encouraging, or it would be absolutely fantastic to see if Malaysia could put a step forward right now and just be like, we're making that step to ensure that, you know, not only everyone, including the future generation, has the right to a healthy environment, but ensuring that we are growing as well as a nation.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually, I mean, whether we like it or not, it's bound to happen. We see, we foresee it coming. We're going to discuss further on Malaysia's road to net zero carbon emissions after the break. Stay tuned, and we'll see you after this. Welcome back to It's About Youth. My name is Soraya Mia. I am speaking with Emily Oyenzi, who is a climate change consultant at the Business Council for Sustainable Development, BCSD, as well as Alia Hasna, who is the co-founder of Bumi, which creates an ecosystem of solutions to tackle the climate crisis. Okay, so we are talking about the transition, Malaysia's transition, you know, to cleaner energy, renewable energy. Just to get a better understanding, you know, on this, the Natural Resources, Environment and Climate Change Minister, Nik Nazmi Nik Ahmad, has actually called for the improvement of renewable energy, or RE. Okay, just give perhaps an understanding of what this renewable energy means and where do we actually start?
Sure. So I think everybody is quite familiar with what renewable energy means. And in Malaysia, our renewable energy also includes hydropower, you know, the large hydro dams that you see mostly in the East Malaysia. And in total, I think in the energy mix, there's about 20%-ish of renewable energy at the moment. So if you take out the hydro, actually large part of it is solar solar energy, but solar energy still remains relatively limited in a sense. There's a few factors. One is technicality, because although we get sunshine all the time in Malaysia, but we have a lot of clouds as well. Mm-hmm. So it limits the solar panel from actually absorbing the solar energy. So there's some technical limitation in that sense. Secondly, I think in terms of regulations, I heard from some solar panels players, they say that it's not very straightforward to get license, and maybe they only limit certain quota and it's not really competitive, so it makes it hard for the solar players to actually come in, and that I think will possess some barrier for international investors to come in as well.
Right. So that's actually a good point. Maybe I would ask Alia, when we talk about all of these problems in the, renewable or clean energy sector, we've been talking about these problems for perhaps like, a couple of years. So what about the solutions? What would you suggest? How do we actually encourage the growth of this renewable energy sector?
Well, with a lot of conversations that's happening around, I think we've been hearing this for the past 5 years, if I'm not mistaken. I think what is really important to really push forward is definitely a stronger political will to ensure that we can basically have more players involved, whether it's internal, within the country or even external, to sort of cultivate that renewable energy sector in our country as well. And of course, like I touched upon a little bit about just transition, right? So because Malaysia is so reliant on reliant on coal and other fossil fuel, totally understandable, because we are growing as a country. But of course, how do we, ensure that the people that are working there would be part of, us moving towards this as well? I think that's also something that we really have to consider to ensure that whatever plans that we have will be implemented, because often enough, Malaysia has a lot of fantastic policies, but when it comes to implementation, I think we're seeing a little lack of it simply because, a little less political will to ensure that this would happen.
I would like to add on a little bit. So actually, when it comes to energy, there's three dimension to it. There's energy security, it's called the energy trilemma. So it's energy security, affordability, and also sustainability. Yeah. So we cannot compromise each of this segment, especially the security part, because we need to provide electricity to our people. And so in this sense, renewable energy might not be the best business case because, like I say, solar, for example, is intermittent, meaning they can only supply power a certain time of the day. That's
limited.
One. Yes. Yeah. So in that sense, actually, a lot of other countries as well, they are using the more low-carbon fossil fuel as the bridging fuel at the moment. So they are slowly phasing out coal, as what Malaysia is doing as well. I think we have a commitment on that as well. And we're moving towards using more natural gas. But know that this is not like forever, but this is like a transition fuel. So my point here is really to tell everybody that RE may not be the best solution, but we may have to live sometimes with a bit of a fossil fuel to provide that security, that stability in terms of energy supply.
I see. So then eventually then we can go into
it. Yes, it's a transition field.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. But as we understand, like this whole renewable energy or energy efficiency sector is perhaps a good opportunity for the future generations. It could create more job opportunities and perhaps business opportunities. We're seeing that a lot in, the West as well. Like this is becoming a very, I would say, popular business opportunity, or for investments. So how can this benefit the young Malaysians? Anyone?
Well, I think, it's safe to say that Malaysian youth are becoming more, or at least they're already aware of the importance of, moving into a much more into sustainable industries or sustainable jobs. So I think when it comes to awareness, it's already there, but it's just more of how can we push them to do more and how can we sort of facilitate that process as well? Because, when we have, for example, we're talking about renewable energy, right? Not only does it provide job creation or job security, but as well as, you know, they're part of, you know, a movement where we're sort of moving into that green energy movement as well. And, you know, it gives also the young people, you know, the chance to be innovative with, you know, the industry. You know, it's not just, you know, a regular 9-to-5 job, but it's just basically them critically thinking, how can we reinvent sustainable future for us? How does it look like, you know, within our context, our culture? So, so these, I can definitely see one of like the biggest benefits of how, you know, young people should get involved and how they can be involved, because if you give them the opportunity, they will, you know, create something absolutely fantastic. So, you know, why not just allow them to be part of it, right? So, yeah.
Talking about, you know, jobs in this whole clean or green sector, or climate change, I would say. Back in like maybe 5 years ago, you know, a lot of jobs are not what they are today. You know, like example, what both of you are doing, maybe you can explain a little bit about that and how it has changed your lives.
Yeah, sure. So actually, Alia and I, we started off in a nonprofit that focuses on youth, and we drive the climate policy agenda. And that is first of its kind in Malaysia, in fact. And we are like one of the pioneers, youth in Malaysia, to move this, and alongside with other youth from the region, yes, internationally as well. And so I think that's one living example where, you know, youth does not just benefit from this trend, but youth can be a game changer in this. And we can create so much things that never exist before. I think whatever we're doing right now is never exist before. And I think this trend will continue, be upwards, and that's definitely more opportunities for our youth.
Mm-hmm. And the good part about this is it's not only just, you know, jobs, opportunities, but it's also change that is attached to it, a responsibility, a sense of purpose as well, which many youths perhaps could relate or resonate to that. Yeah. But, you know, talking about probably climate adaptation or climate mitigation measures. Is the current Malaysian syllabus in-depth or enough to actually educate the younger generations? Because we understand, you know, the mainstream education systems in Sekolah Kebangsaan, Sekolah Menengah Kebangsaan and all of this, is the syllabus enough to educate the youth of the importance of climate topics, climate crisis conversations?
Well, I think in to have this conversation, I don't think it's something that we can develop once and say that this is enough in terms of education. I think education is something that it's a lifelong process, right? And I think we should look at it as in a way that it's ever-changing, right? With the current context of climate change, our education system should also adapt to it as well. And I think in terms of formal education in Sekolah Kebangsaan and whatnot, I think we should see it as an integration across multiple subjects, you know, for science, geography, and all that, so that, you know, students can also think about how it's not really a one-way conversation, but rather that you can see it on multiple aspects on how climate change is affecting, you know, the way we live, the way we think, the way we do business as well. And, you know, the future generation, I think, you know, are equipped with the basic knowledge as of now. But because, again, this is ever changing, right? But what definitely we can do more is maybe have as well as more on-field activities, you know, how they can really engage, because theoretical is one thing, right? But I think for students or for younger generation, they should really be involved in the process with it, right? So whether it's going on community field trips or speaking to, you know, experts, you know, policymakers, scientists, you know, these are one of the many, many things. But also we should also focus on informal education as well, you know, and involve a larger community, because it's not just the burden should not weigh on just the future generation, but it really is, you know, talking about a collective action, you know, intergenerational action as well, so that, you know, the current generation as well as the future generation can really work together and create something that is, you know, ever changing or game changing, as Emily would say, for, you know, the context of our current climate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how do we actually improve, you know, the education, not only with, among the youths, but also perhaps in corporate worlds, you know, when we talk about the commitments of certain, there are, you know, some companies that are already committed to, you know, net zero targets, yeah, or other commitments, international commitments. So how do we increase this, raise more awareness on this conversation?
Right. Actually, the big companies in Malaysia, for example, they have already passed the stage of, you know, trying to understand what is this, which is a good sign. And when this happened, it will trickle down to their supply chain, which will also affect the SMEs. And now what I'm seeing is the SMEs are the one that's like, oh, what is this? What am I supposed to do? Yeah. So it's good. So I think, you know, the big companies are definitely taking the lead, and it will essentially also help SME and facilitate this process.
Mm, yeah, and I hear a lot about the, you know, these carbon credits. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so people are talking about, yeah, you can buy carbon credits and carbon neutralize, yeah, your company or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So tell us how it works.
Right. Essentially, it's like stock market, but instead of trading stocks, you trade carbons. But note that in the net zero equation, carbon offset is always the last part of the equation. So the principle that the UN actually advocate is you have to reduce your emission until you cannot do anything else, then only you offset it. And when I say offset, it's like you buy carbon credits from another organization or a country that has extra carbon credits. For example, if Malaysia, we have more forests and our forests actually absorb more carbon and we have the extra credits, and then we can sell it to other countries, for example.
Yeah. Mm, okay, yeah, that's interesting.
But I think just to add on to that, it's not a standalone mechanism that would help us transition. I think it's important to see that it's definitely one of the aspects to help us, yeah, to transition.
Yeah. I see. All right. Well, that's such an insightful conversation. I feel like there's definitely a lot more that we must touch on. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, you know, maybe in the future I could speak with both of you again. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing your insights. That's all for It's About Youth today. My name is Raya Mia, and we'll see you in the next episode.